This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 15th, 2011. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Occupy protesters in New York regroup after police make arrests and clear the encampment. We'll get the latest. Labor and immigrant rights groups call for stronger protections against toxic pesticides for farm workers. And we'll go to Madison, Wisconsin, where the effort to recall Governor Scott Walker begins. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The chair of the Syrian National Council called for UN troops today. Burhan Galyun said the force is needed after he met with Russia's foreign minister. Russia continues to supply arms to President Bashar al-Assad. Turkey provides Syria with electricity, but threatened today to cut off supplies. Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Erdogan.
A future cannot be built on the blood of oppressed people. Otherwise, history will remember such leaders as those feeding on blood. Assad, you are on your way to open that page. Those who are cursed for cruelty and oppression will pay the price sooner or later.
The death toll from violence yesterday continues to rise. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that 81 people were killed. The Arab League met again with opposition members today. President Assad has called for an emergency Arab League summit after the group voted to suspend Syria, effective Wednesday. 15 of the group's 22 members need to agree in order to convene such a meeting. Six have already said no. At least one noted political dissident was released from Syrian prison today. Kamal al-Labwani was reunited with his family after 6 years in jail. According to state media, more than 1,100 other political prisoners were also set free. Five monks in Myanmar staged a rare public protest today. They locked themselves inside a museum in Mandalay and unfurled banners from the balcony that read, "Free all political prisoners," and "We want freedom," in both Burmese and English. The military junta in the country, also called Burma, ceded power earlier this year, but the current regime continues to hold some 2,000 political prisoners. Authorities stood with hundreds of bystanders as the monks addressed the public. They later left the museum to continue their action at a nearby monastery. Russia is on the verge of World Trade Organization membership after formally agreeing to a package of requirements and striking a key deal with Georgia in recent days. The agreement will see the country become more open to foreign goods and services, but some fear that it will worsen the economic situation. Ekaterina Danilova reports.
Russian officials are certain that membership in the WTO means that Russia will join the club of modern, efficient economies. President Dmitry Medvedev says joining the WTO means Russia will concentrate less on being the world's leading supplier of oil and gas.
We must not only develop our energy resources, we must also develop different parts of our economy. And in that sense, of course, the WTO will enable the development of our economy and diversify our companies.
But some in Russia are opposing the move to join the trade organization. The movement to stop WTO is warning that Russia's membership will only benefit large corporations in the United States and Europe. They say most people in Russia will suffer because poverty will rise. Labor groups predict an increase in prices but wage stagnation. There are also environmental concerns about the forced allowance of GMO products. Trade ministers are expected to give Russia the final stamp of approval at the WTO ministerial meeting in December. But the EU could still veto the agreement if Russia doesn't end hefty fees for European airlines to fly over Siberia to Asia. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
TransCanada Corporation says it supports legislation currently in the Nebraska Congress that would reroute the proposed Keystone XL pipeline around the state's sand hills and the Ogallala Aquifer. The move is not a surprise, given that last week the U.S. State Department announced a delay in the pipeline approval process while alternate routes were studied. Nebraska says they can conduct a new review in the next 6 months. But in last week's State Department announcement, Dr. Kerri-Anne Jones said that they plan to do a national interest review that is truly comprehensive. Bill McKibben says he hopes that means there will be a full consideration of climate and public health issues surrounding tar sands oil before any presidential permit is granted. Pakistan's High Court issued an order yesterday to the nation's Elections Commission to begin registering transsexuals to vote. The High Court, led by Justice Iftikhar Chaudhry, also ordered that the National Database and Registry allow those who identify neither as male nor female to choose a third gender identity. The court action is the latest in a series of orders that grant civil rights to citizens who were formerly ostracized. Transgender Pakistanis have historically been denied an education and relegated to begging or prostitution. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In New York City, police raided the Occupy Wall Street encampment in the middle of the night, arresting 200 protesters and clearing the camp. Demonstrators secured a court order protecting their right to be in the park, but city officials are pressing to keep the encampment closed. The action comes a day after Oakland police cleared that city's Occupy encampment. Community News Production Institute reporter Jessel Knorr reports.
Shortly after midnight, hundreds of baton and shield-wielding New York riot police carried out a surprise raid on the Occupy Wall Street encampment, where hundreds of protesters have camped out for 2 months. Police demanded campers leave the park with their belongings or be arrested. Many left voluntarily, but more than 100 resisted nonviolently, locking arms together to defend their camp. But their efforts were defeated, and police violently arrested the remaining protesters and tore down the camp, removing tents and clearing all the protesters' belongings, including the Occupy Wall Street library, which contained approximately 5,000 books.
You guys need to back up!
Shane Stoops has slept at Zuccotti Park since September 17th and says the eviction was not legally justified.
They had no legal warrant. They had no judge sign their warrants to come in. We asked repeatedly to see the warrants for eviction. No cop ever showed them to us. No white shirt ever showed us anything. All they gave us was a phony frickin' notice saying about how we are a health and fire hazard.
The police have been criticized for preventing media from approaching Zuccotti Park during the raid and for using batons and pepper spray to disperse the remaining protesters. Following the raid, demonstrators regrouped at several locations in Lower Manhattan. At 6 a.m., the Liberty Park Legal Working Group and National Lawyers Guild secured a temporary restraining order from New York Judge Lucy Billings, allowing protesters back into the park. But when hundreds of Occupy protesters returned at 11 a.m., demanding entry, police officers refused to let them in.
Take it back! Take it back!
Occupy participant Devon Jackson says they won't give up until they're allowed back in the park.
My message right now is if they don't know the law, they need to give up their badges because they are in direct violation of a court order. They are in contempt, and we have the right to re-enter this park legally and constitutionally. We have the right to assemble, and we will stay assembled until we re-enter this park. End of story.
Demonstrators have been aided by legal groups, including the Center for Constitutional Rights. Its president emeritus, Michael Ratner, said Mayor Michael Bloomberg and the city of New York need to be held accountable for violating the court order.
And they're holding us up so far, and it's amazing to me because this is a court order from a Supreme Court judge. So essentially, Mayor Bloomberg, the city, and the cops are violating a court order. They should, and I hope will, be held in contempt of court. But, you know, they consider themselves bigger than the court system.
Occupied protesters say despite the crackdown, they're expecting thousands to turn out on Thursday, when supporters will mark the movement entering its third month by attempting to shut down Wall Street. Jessel Knorr, FSRN, New York.
Hi, this is Jess Burns. I'm a headlines editor at FSRN. Free Speech Radio News is a distinct voice you can find on your radio dial, your computer browser, and on your smartphone. But the strength of that voice is that it isn't the voice of one reporter, one personality, one editor, one corporation. FSRN is the voice of many. It's a voice of the people, striving to find clarity in the chaos. Find out how you can add your voice to the mix. Visit us online at fsrn.org.
Earlier this month, advocates celebrated Bank of America's decision to abandon plans to charge users for monthly debit card fees. The news came after intense public pressure, but the banks are looking for other sources of revenue, and many continue to profit off some of the most vulnerable people in the country, the unemployed. Alice Olstein reports from Washington.
At least 40 states have contracted with Bank of America, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, and other financial firms to distribute unemployment benefits through prepaid debit cards. And since many of these contracts allow for unlimited fees, the banks are raking in big profits. According to the Western Center on Law and Poverty, Californians on public assistance paid $8 million in surcharges in 2008 and may pay more than double that this year. Ken Edwards from the consumer advocacy group Center for Responsible Lending calls the system predatory.
You have an unbanked and underbanked population that is relying on using these technologies, and they have unfortunately been taken advantage of by some prepaid card providers, which, you know, nickel and dime them with fees on the scarce resources that they have.
Edwards listed some of the fees unemployed people may encounter when accessing their benefits.
Balance inquiry fees, fees for using the cards at ATMs, swipe fees, all sorts of fees. And these are people right now who can ill afford to have their precious resources being gnawed at by the fees that are not transparent.
He said the bank's rules often put customers in a catch-22 situation where they're fined for overdrawing, but when they check their balance to make sure they don't overdraw, they're fined for that as well. Prepaid debit cards do have some advantages. Those living on unemployment who don't have bank accounts no longer have to pay a fee to cash their weekly check, and states save by not having to print and mail the checks in the first place. But Maurice Emsalem from the National Employment Law Project says some states got a much better deal than others due to their size and financial know-how.
Right now, 50 states are negotiating 50 different deals with a number of different banks. So in one state, there's certain fees on the cards. In other states, there are not. It may be the same bank that's charging fees in one state and they're not in another state. So, I mean, I think the first step is to make sure that the federal government is more actively involved in helping to negotiate these contracts so that they're getting the best deal for the worker. That's not happening right now.
A new report from the National Consumer Law Center found that California and New Jersey negotiated the best deals with the fewest fees, while Tennessee, which uses JP Morgan Chase, had the most fees. In that state, unemployment benefit recipients must pay a dollar every time they use their own bank's ATM, 25 cents for every purchase requiring a PIN number, and 40 cents every time they want to check their balance. And it's not just the unemployed getting hit by under-the-radar charges. Now that the government has eliminated swipe fees paid by merchants and public pressure made major banks back down on monthly debit card fees, banks have had to find other ways to boost profits. Some lawmakers on Capitol Hill are calling on federal regulatory agencies to mandate full disclosure of such fees. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin recently brought the issue to the Senate floor.
Well, certainly we want more transparency, competition, and choice. But in order for that to happen, we need more disclosures so that the average customer of a bank knows what they're getting into. Have any of us taken the time to read the back of that monthly credit card statement? As a lawyer, I can tell you that if you ask for the entire statement concerning fees at banks, it's over 100 pages, almost impossible to decipher.
Earlier this year, a study by the Pew Foundation found that banks' checking account disclosure forms clock in at an average of 111 pages. The study also found that checking account users at major banks could be charged nearly 50 different fees on average, and that customers will collectively spend $38 billion in overdraft fees in 2011 alone. Senator Durbin and Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed are petitioning the newly created Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Department of Labor to force banks to adopt a concise fee disclosure form that any consumer can understand. They say their efforts will make bank fee information as easy to find and read as the nutrition label on a cereal box. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Labor, immigrant, and environmental justice advocates are calling on the EPA to put in place stronger standards for farm workers exposed to dangerous pesticides. According to the American Journal of Industrial Medicine, farm workers and their children are at risk of developing serious chronic health problems such as cancer, neurological impairments, and disease due to long-term exposure to toxic pesticides. The EPA is expected to announce revisions to the existing protections early next year. Critics say the current law fails to protect agricultural workers, placing an unfair burden on poor and minority communities. For more, we turn to Eve Gartner. She's staff attorney with Earth Justice, a nonprofit public interest law firm, and one of the lead groups that prepared the petition to the EPA. She joins us from New York. Welcome to FSRN.
Great. Thanks, Dorian. I'm happy to be here.
Your petition is addressed to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson. It's submitted on behalf of agriculture workers and groups such as the United Farm Workers. What specifically are you calling for?
Well, Dorian, most people probably don't know it, but if they're employed in the United States, most people are protected from workplace hazards by an agency called the Office of Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. But that's not the case for farm workers. Farm workers are not protected by OSHA. They're protected by EPA. And the fact is that EPA has much more lax standards for protection than most workers get. Most workers get the gold standard, and farm workers really get kind of the rust standard here. There are many, many protections that are standard for workers that use hazardous chemicals like pesticides, but farm workers are not getting those. So the overall thing that we're asking for is that farm workers get the same level of protection when they work with pesticides as other workers get when they work with hazardous chemicals, including pesticides, but also including other kinds of hazardous chemicals.
Right. The OSHA, or the Office of Safety and Health Administration, most people are probably familiar with that. You see the regulations in your workplace, and agriculture workers are not covered with that. Now, in the petition, you call the standards developed by the EPA back in 1992 grossly inadequate. Can you get into a couple of the specifics of how agriculture workers are not covered and what that means for them?
Sure. There are three particular things that we're really focusing on. We're asking for many things, but there are three standards that are the focus. One is something very basic. When farm workers are pouring pesticides or mixing pesticides, they should have access to systems that enclose the pesticides in tubes or in containers with covers so they don't have pesticides splashing on them, blowing into their face, which is the norm now. So that's one thing. We're asking that workers have access to closed systems for mixing and loading the pesticides. Another specific thing we're asking for is that for workers who are driving tractors that are spraying pesticides into the air, we're asking that those tractors have enclosed cabs or covers so that the workers aren't literally sitting in cloud of pesticide dust all day long as they're spraying pesticides onto crops. And the third thing that we're focusing on is a few particular categories of pesticides that are truly the most toxic pesticides known to man. They're essentially nerve gas. They affect the nervous system in a very serious way. And we're asking that workers who are exposed to those pesticides have their blood periodically monitored to make sure that the levels they're being exposed to aren't essentially putting them at risk of death because of the impact on their nervous system. And that can be detected in blood tests. We're just saying that those workers should have periodic blood tests so that those levels can be detected before it's truly life-threatening.
Well, the reforms you outlined there appear basic. They're not overreaching. They're bringing the EPA standards up to speed with OSHA. Meanwhile, there are these repeated scientific studies that have shown the dangers of pesticide, and they bear repeating. The American Journal of Industrial Medicine compared retired workers from the United Farm Workers with other Latinos and found elevated rates of certain cancers, including 59% higher rate of leukemia, 69% 60% higher rate of stomach cancer, 63% higher rate of uterine or cervix cancer, and the data goes on and on. Where is the resistance to these reforms coming from, and how do you foresee this in the next couple months?
Right. Well, you know, clearly the resistance on the other side is coming from the growers, from the farmers who don't want to pay for the ramifications of their reliance on hazardous chemicals in order to grow their crops. These are not expensive things that we're asking for, however. As we explain in our petition to EPA, several of these are already required in the state of California and have been required for decades. So if growers in the state of California can comply with these and still make a profit, I don't think that they're going to bankrupt the growers in other states.
And again, those revisions are expected in the early part of next year?
Well, that's what EPA is saying now. You know, of course, whether that actually happens, we'll wait and see. But that's another aspect of why we're going to be following up, not just to make sure that what we're asking for is in the revisions, but simply to make sure that the revisions actually do come out of EPA early next year.
Eve Gardner is a staff attorney with Earth Justice. That's one of the groups that filed a petition calling on the EPA to adopt stricter standards to protect farm workers from pesticides. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Great. Thank you, Dorian.
Join us this week for a special interview with author and activist Arundhati Roy.
What is it that connects the Wall Street occupation to the people in the forest?
Roy's new book, Walking with the Comrades, brings a first-hand account of the hidden side of corporate greed in the forests of India, and she connects it to the worldwide protests taking place in cities across the globe.
What connects it is absolute exclusion of the majority of the people in the world for the obscene benefit of a very few.
Join us for a conversation with Arundhati Roy about her time with the Maoist guerrillas in the forests of India. That's Thursday on FSRN. The campaign to recall Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has officially begun. Wisconsin residents outraged by the governor's union-busting laws and massive budget cuts seek to remove him from office. They have 60 days to collect more than 500,000 signatures to force a new election. Molly Stentz from WORT in Madison has the story.
Thanks for coming out tonight. We are about to announce the launch of the Scott Walker recall kickoff.
In bars around Wisconsin Monday night, it felt like New Year's Eve. People waited for the clock to strike midnight to sign petitions to recall Governor Scott Walker. Now the clock is ticking. Organizers have to turn in more than 500,000 signatures from Wisconsin voters in just 2 months. If they're successful, it will mean forcing the governor to run for re-election next spring. Many Wisconsinites are upset with the governor for crushing the state's long history of union rights for public workers. He launched the attack on his first month on the job. The group leading the recall campaign is called United Wisconsin. Founder Michael Brown says people across the state have been waiting months for this moment. They're aiming to turn in all those signatures at the soonest possible opportunity, which will be mid-January. State law requires an elected official to be in office for 1 year before they can be recalled.
We are able to show the country and the world that democracy is alive and well in America.
Brown says it's necessary to recall Governor Walker because he broke campaign promises to create jobs, misled voters about his agenda, and neglected the needs of working Wisconsinites.
It definitely needs to be done because Scott Walker has definitely and consistently put the special corporate interests ahead of the average Wisconsin resident. This is about families. This is about, you know, putting food on your table and, you know, having health care for your children and a good education for our children. That's what this is about. And those are the people that he is not taking care of. So that is why this is necessary.
On Tuesday morning, Wisconsin resident Julie Wells filed paperwork at the state office in Madison to officially kick off the recall. She said she'd never done anything political like this before, but said it needed to be done because the governor was destroying the state.
We're going to do this. We're taking back our state.
Governor Walker has responded to the recall efforts by launching a campaign ad, which ran during the heavily watched Green Bay Packers football game Monday night.
You know, Wisconsin's best days are yet to come. It won't happen overnight, but we are on our way.
Unlike regular elections, there are no limits to the amount of money a candidate can raise during a recall. Campaign organizers say they also plan to file paperwork to recall the lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clayfish, who was elected with Walker last year, as well as three Republican state senators who backed the governor and are eligible for recall. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
From state tents to Penn State, the shocking child sex scandal rocking Penn State University in State College, Pennsylvania, is an explosion of almost nuclear proportions. It has all the elements designed to produce a media firestorm: fame, money, illicit sex, deception, and yes, betrayal. But the core of it is betrayal of the country's deepest religion, sports, and of those who we claim to adore and revere the most, children. The scandal has shown how great wealth, fame, and the business of college sports corrupted everything and everyone to keep the gravy train rolling. And the Penn State football program was and is an extremely lucrative gravy train, bringing in tens of millions of dollars in fees from TV, advertising, and souvenir sales. Penn State University itself is the biggest employer in State College and is one of the biggest 10 colleges in the U.S. with over 45,000 students. The gravy here flowed thick and lumpy. And like other great wealth-making and powerful institutions, its sins were covered so as not to rock the boat. It reminds us of the great scandals that shook the foundations of the Catholic Church back in the 90s, the ripples of which are still with us. They remind us that rape is about power, and sex is but a tool of domination of the weak by the powerful. That same dynamic is at work whether it's a man and a woman, a priest and a child, or a coach and a boy. But is it the same when it's two men? How about when one man is a prison guard and another is a prisoner? When news leaked out several months ago that rapes were widespread in the blocks of the state prison in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the reaction was local, mostly concentrated in western Pennsylvania. Here it has all the dynamics of the rape culture we've discussed. Powerful against powerless. Indeed, in some respects, it's more pronounced, for systems are in place to protect women and children, which necessitates hiding these things. But in a Pennsylvania prison, an indicted guard, Harry Nicoletti, allegedly used his power as a state prison official to threaten men he raped and abused with being sent to the hole and death if they told. He ordered prisoners to contaminate food with spit, urine, and feces. He punched, slapped, and spat on prisoners. He used racist language with abandon. And these things happened for years. Schools, churches, and prisons, institutions of immense power, exploiting, abusing, and hurting the powerless in the places which seemingly attracts rapeaholics. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Shauna Ray. FSRN is largely funded by listeners like you. Find out how you can support independent journalism during our Clarity in the Chaos campaign. More information is available on our website at fsrn.org. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us at comments@fsrn.org. For more news story specials and our documentaries, visit our website and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.